Hello, welcome to episode 2, series 2 of Sport and the Feels. I'm Jonathan Overend. If you missed series 1 that ran throughout what would have been the Olympic Games, make sure you download it. That's still very much available. This series is running throughout the scheduled Tokyo Paralympic Games. Yes, the Paralympic movement, which started with those early competitions at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, turned into the first proper Paralympics in Rome, 1960, to run parallel to the Olympic Games. That was the idea. If we're honest about it, it hasn't all been plain sailing since. Atlanta in 1996 wasn't great. Tanny Gray-Thompson was telling you about that in episode 1. I remember Athens, not brilliant in 2004, but then the improvement, Beijing, much better. And we arrived at London 2012, knowing that this truly could be something special. We'd had the London Olympic Games, of course. Andy Murray was on his way to winning his first Grand Slam title in New York at the US Open. This was going to be special. But in terms of the way it was conveyed to a British audience, it needed a bold, ambitious production team, which it had from Channel 4, and it needed a bold, ambitious presentation team, which was headed by the guest on today's pod. It's Claire Balding. Well, my co-host on this second episode of the series, and it is a world premiere for Sport on the Fields because we are welcoming her onto the team for this series. I'm delighted to say it's Lee McKenzie. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Jonathan. I am delighted to be involved because I think I've bothered you just about every day one of the Sport in the Fields pods came out the last time. I absolutely loved it. I loved hearing the stories. So to be involved in this and on the Paralympics, which is a subject very close to my heart. It's a real pleasure.
Good. Yes, you were our kind of head of quality control on social media. So I was very grateful for that. And we're delighted to have you with us because you were part of the Channel 4 team at Rio 2016. You were there trackside working with some of the greats, interviewing some of the greats as well. And I mean, just tell us what that was like, first of all, you know, being so close to such great sport.
It was hugely exciting. You know, I had done the Olympics for BBC, then came home and then went back out for the Paralympics. And I wasn't really sure what to expect. I'd never covered a Paralympics before. But my goodness, it was just a real thrill. The crowds were wonderful. All the scare stories that we had in the run up to it didn't come to fruition. You know, there were maybe some problems with transport, but my goodness, there always are problems with transport when you spend any time in Brazil. It was a real success. The sport was wonderful as well. I started off in the velodrome. I tried to see just about every discipline I could. I ended up doing the equestrian, which I've worked with the British Para Dressage team before. And to see their success again was just really heartening. But just the quality of the sport was really what made it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And that's probably what I learned the most during my fortnight at the Rio Paralympics. You know, you go there and you're so excited because it's a first-time experience, as it was for me at the Paralympic Games. And you're wide-eyed, you're open-eared, you want to hear stories, you want to find out about the individual's journeys, absolutely. But then you get in your seat, you're in amongst the crowd, and you're watching amazing sport, great matches, fantastic races, achievements, accomplishments, world records, medals. We're massive sport fans, you know, and that's why we watch sport. That's why we love sport. That's why we're doing a series like this. And if you can't see great sport at something like the Paralympic Games without seeing the disability, then something is going wrong somewhere. And I really believe that we have to change the direction of the conversation, the manner of the conversation, away from somehow seeing disability sport as a minority sport. We're talking track and field, football, cycling, swimming. These are not minority sports, Lee.
They definitely aren't. And actually, I was doing some work with Sport Scotland and particularly with Scottish Swimming. And they have quite a large number of children with disabilities who go swimming 3 times a week, who want to be part of swimming clubs. And they will have been inspired by your Ellie Simmons, by all the swimmers that we have seen doing ever so well during para swimming events, not just at the Paralympics, but also that's something that Channel 4 has supported throughout different world championships and competitions as well. But there are an awful lot of talented athletes out there who have either been born with a disability or end up inheriting one through either illness or accident. These people are hugely talented athletes. It's not a minority sport. It's a sport there for all. And it doesn't matter, you know, if you're in a swimming club, you'll be training alongside able-bodied athletes in dressage. Sophie Wells is a great example. She's one of the best para-dressage riders, but she also competes against able-bodied riders because there are just not enough competitions for her and her horse to be at the standard that they need to be. So I think it's always worth remembering that.
Yeah. Well, on the Olympic pod, we had Claire Balding on, and I was struck by one of the things she said. When she turned down a gig at a racing channel very early in her career, and it would have, you know, would have been a lot of money, it would have been life-changing stuff for her, but she turned it down. She said, you're not going to be able to send me to the Olympic Games. But she also said she was working at the Paralympics as well at that time, and that was also on her mind. There's no doubt that Claire has been a huge advocate of the Paralympic movement for two decades or more, and in 2012, her fronting of the Channel 4 coverage was a moment in time, really. So it's great to get her on this second series once more. Let's bring Claire Balding back on the pod. Well, hi, Claire. Good to chat again. And we've got Lee with us now. So I think I'm just going to have to take a back seat, because if the British Airways flight back from Rio is anything to go by, you two are just going to keep us occupied for half an hour.
What did we do? I don't remember.
I think that's the point.
I think actually that was probably the quietest part, because we'd had 7 weeks together before that. So the flight back was probably us decompressing. But I think Rio ran out of gin pretty swiftly after we'd left. So
I get very easily led astray. I get very easily led astray. Lee is a good leader.
I dispute that claim.
Well, great to have the chance to talk Paralympics. I must ask you how your kittens are, first of all. They were new arrivals, weren't they, when we chatted on the Olympics pod?
Yes, they are. They're just gorgeous. So they're going to be 7 weeks old very soon. And they are divine. They had their first photo shoot yesterday because we wanted to get nice photos of them all before they go. So two of them, Eric and Pickle, are very keen on the camera. Gordon hid in the litter tray. Simba ran away. And Colin, who's now known as Freddie, because my friend who's having him doesn't want him called Colin for some reason. Freddie was sort of grin and bear it. He kind of got on with it, but didn't really love it. Whereas two of them really loved it. And we've realised they should be doing adverts.
Eric and Pickle, though. You know, there's an MP called Eric Pickles.
Oh, God, there is. Yes, I should. Yes, I'm not sure. Yes.
And Colin? I mean, dare we ask about Colin?
Well, we just always quite wanted an animal called Colin because I think it's funny. But as I say, he's the one that's now been renamed, because my friend Toe didn't think that was particularly funny and wants to call him Freddie. So that's fine. He's wants us to call him Freddie at home so that when she gets him, he's used to being called Freddie.
How many are you going to keep, Claire?
Just one, yeah. But the others are going to people that I know. So one is my old school friend for her 50th birthday present. One's going next door, so we're hoping he might come and visit us. Again, the kids are very excited next door about that. They've just been in France, so they're currently in lockdown. So the only I can speak to them over the garden fence, and it's literally, this is the only thing keeping them going, is knowing they're getting a kitten. And then one's going to Alice's brother, and so on and so forth. We'll know where they all are.
So Lee, you worked with Claire on Channel 4 at the Rio Paralympics. That must have been amazingly exciting, given the job that Claire and the team had done in 2012 to take the Games basically onto a whole new level in terms of audience awareness in the UK.
Yes, Lee, how exciting was it to work with me?
Well, before I was really excited, and then afterwards, I don't think we spoke for about 3 years. No, it was wonderful. In fact, it was my first Olympic Games as well for the BBC. And a lot of people had said to me, look, you know, the Olympics is wonderful, but you will absolutely love the Paralympics. There's just so much more time. There's still an awful lot of pressure, but it's it's just a completely different atmosphere. So I was really excited to sort of see what I would find when I went back, because don't forget, there'd obviously been a lot of scare stories as well, that, you know, that there wouldn't be many television cameras, and that was something that we needed to create a really high level of coverage that Channel 4 was known for, particularly after 2012. For me personally, I loved being at the Paralympics, and it opened my eyes to para sport, and I've gone on to present quite a bit since then, and I have a real genuine love for it.
It's been really interesting, historically, the coverage of Paralympic sport, and bear in mind that in 1996 in Atlanta, it was rock bottom, appalling, and Helen Rollison did a very famous and very powerful piece to camera where she said this should never be allowed to happen again. There was no concern for the athletes. The village had not been designed with access in mind. There was no promotion of the tickets. The facilities were poor. Nobody was watching American television, as in nobody was watching there physically, no crowds. And American television hasn't been wonderful, actually, at covering the Paralympic Games for a variety of reasons, some of them political, but just short-sightedness, I think. The first Paralympic Games I then went to, it was in 2000 in Sydney, and I covered that for the BBC, and we did it as recorded highlights. We got a lot of coverage out there, but because of the time difference, it wasn't live. And then 4 years later, in Athens, we started doing live coverage, and it built and built, and I think in terms of hours and output, it built on the BBC. But when Channel 4 came in 2012, they just had a really different approach. And they, because it was London, it was a home games, everything was going to be covered. We had cameras everywhere. And also Seb Cohen, as part of the bid for London 2012, had made it very clear that this was about the Paralympics being parallel to the Olympics, which is what it means and what it's meant to be, but had never happened in broadcast terms before. So the village was designed, obviously, with both games in mind, all the venues, everything, and ticket sales were off the scale. Channel 4 won the BAFTA for that coverage. They also introduced The Last Leg, which I think brought a real showbiz side to the coverage, which I think is really important and has happened in sport for quite a while, but had never happened with Paralympic athletes at the heart of it. And obviously with disability and the wider messages of the Paralympics being talked about and laughed about. And, you know, is it OK? Is it OK to say this? Is it OK to say that? Is it OK to highlight this issue? Is it OK to have fun here? And I think that created a very different atmosphere. And that certainly went through to 2016. And the decision to take the last leg team to Rio, I think, was really bold and really paid off. And in terms of coverage, I mean, we were on for all hours, and it was just great, the vibrancy, the excitement. Obviously, the British team did extremely well again. And I think the characters that had been built from before London, through London, and then on to Rio, people really cared. They knew more, they understood more, they wanted to follow people's stories, and that is what always in sport, that's what matters, yeah. I think.
And were you asking initially, you know, in 2000 and 2004, were you asking those sort of, am I allowed to do this sort of questions?
In a sense, well, I was covering it very purely as sport with humanity, if you yes. like. And that's that, you know, that's what I would try and do with everything. But, you know, you are building stories so that people want to watch, but you're very conscious. And I was always very conscious. This is high level sport. And you ask questions about sport. You don't go straight in with a question about somebody's disability. But interestingly, when we were doing London, I went out in the park and Adi Adepitan and I did a section called Ask Adi, which I was really keen to do because I wanted to get out of the studio and I wanted crowds around, you know, just to get a feel for what was happening and what people were wanting to see and what they wanted to know. So this was the chance for kids to ask Adi anything they wanted. They never asked him about his disability. They wanted to know how many wheelchairs does he have, how much do they cost, how fast can he go. They knew he played wheelchair basketball, so, you know, how successful had he been? Had he won a gold medal? You know, who was the fastest athlete at the Paralympics? You know, who's going to win the most medals? Questions like that. And it was just that reminder that people, you don't need to zero in on the disability first and foremost. That is not the headline. It may be the reason people are competing at the Paralympics, but it's not the headline. And it's part of the coverage. And I think we did some really good explainers, actually. And I think the whole system coming in, what was it called, Lee? What was the system called that Giles Long developed? You know, the one that
Lexi.
Lexi, that's it.
Yeah, the Lexi system.
Yeah, and that, don't you think that was really helpful at explaining different categories?
Absolutely, because I think the one thing for me, and I was really worried because, as Claire said, you know, this is sport. You know, sport with humanity is a wonderful phrase, but all of these athletes, I would say, no matter what they're doing, are doing something that most people sitting on their sofa and watching at home could not do themselves, even as able-bodied. And I think that's really important to get across. And, you know, I was nervous about how to do this for the first time. But when you actually speak to the athletes, you know, they don't necessarily have a grip on which category is which. And when I did the para athletics in particular, alongside Johnny Peacock and David Weir and Liam Malone, they were saying things like, is this T38 or T42? I never really understand what that means. And you're thinking to yourself, well, it's not just me. And it is very complicated. So Channel 4 put a lot of background and resource into making these explainer VTs and actually using the athletes to do it. And I think that was really important as well, to get their personality over, but also it's much better when it comes from the athlete.
And the Superhumans campaign.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was yeah, groundbreaking, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that the level of investment, because, and again, this is, you know, it's sort of techie broadcast stuff, but it's interesting. Because Channel 4 could get commercial partners, whether it was BP or BT, or there was another very high, I think Aviva did the bumpers for Rio. They could do really high quality short form films that just looked so Hollywood. You know, the one of Johnny Peacock jumping London Tower, no, which is the bridge that comes up? Tower Bridge. Tower Bridge comes up, doesn't it? And Tower leaping Bridge. Across it. I mean, that was just beautiful. And that really helps. And I think that, as I say, the Stardust has come to the Paralympics only in recent years. And I think it has, yes, there's still sport at the core of it, but it just takes it to another very important commercial level.
And you can actually see that with athletes now being invited onto Strictly, because they have a personality. They're not just a disability athlete. You know, those sorts of little VTs and films that Claire was talking about, The Last Leg, showing how funny a lot of these people are. It's actually given them a strong personality, and now they're on, you know, on primetime television on a Saturday, dancing alongside able-bodied athletes, completely out of their comfort zone and becoming household names.
Yeah, and you look at Ellie Simmons going on Bake Off as well, and Kadena Cox has been on Bake Off or MasterChef or probably both. I mean, it's really great because you get to see people, and we want this across sport. You only really get to know the athlete when you can see them without wearing their helmet or their swimming goggles or without being on the track, without being in focus mode. Being able to see them when they're relaxed is really important.
We love reminiscing about your infamous Bert Leclos interview during the London Olympic Games, Claire. Has anything come close in your Paralympic career? You must have met a few characters.
Oh God, Lee Pearson, who Lee knows as well, who Sir Lee Pearson, as he is now, who's competed in the equestrian team for many, many years, is one of the funniest men and outspoken and outrageous men I've ever met. And any interview with Lee Pearson is going to be hugely unpredictable. But I think Liam Malone ran him close, don't you think, Lee, in terms of being a TV star in Rio?
Yeah, I mean, Lee Pearson, I would wholeheartedly agree. If you can get through an interview where he doesn't call you babe or darling or like comment on what you're wearing or something, even though he's sitting, he's just won a medal, or swear, you've done pretty well. Liam Malone was like nobody else I have ever worked with. And during the World Para Athletics, even though he wasn't competing, he was actually just standing with me on Channel 4. I think most nights he was trending on Twitter. I mean, you couldn't make it up. He was just like very good looking, very cool. Had won a gold medal in the 200.
Very confident.
Very confident. Would just every time, in it didn't matter what the whether it be javelin or 100 meters, he'd be like, "Yeah, I'd be better than that. but he'd say it out loud on television. And he was the current 200-metre gold medalist from Rio. So he actually wouldn't have been competing in anything apart from the 200 metres, but he had the self-belief that he could just have beaten anyone. And, but most people wouldn't say that necessarily out loud. Oh, he didn't mind at all. I mean, even David Weir, Johnny Peacock, they just basically stood wide-eyed staring at him, just completely... sort of wondering where on earth this guy has come from. But there was an awful lot of bravado. And one thing during those World Paras, I actually wanted, I think it might have got a little bit out of control, his confidence. And at the end of it, we did a really lovely VT about why he needed to come across that way. And it all stemmed from his childhood and being bullied in New Zealand. And he had wooden legs at that time. And he wanted to be the fastest man on earth, just to almost prove a point to himself. He'd lost his mother at an early age. So there was an actual, a real humanity, like Claire mentioned, behind it all. But for him, it really manifested in this outrageous confidence. And he has gone on to become a stand-up comedian.
Has he?
He might be on the last leg in a very different capacity. Yes, he has.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how successful, but he is doing stand-up comedy. And I think he was very much inspired by his appearances on The Last Leg.
Wow, good for him. I mean, it's really lovely when you get a character like that, and actually we were able to give him the platform that he wasn't getting, because New Zealand were, I don't think they were doing live coverage, and I think fairly limited in what they were offering back home. Yeah. So he suddenly got a profile which he'd never had before. And I find quite often with the American athletes, just going back to the lack of investment from the rights holders in America in the Paralympics, Seb Coe, just to finish that story, in London, made it a condition of the positions that he gave NBC for the Olympics that they also gave the Paralympics greater coverage. And again in Rio, I think they increased their coverage. They're still not doing, I mean, they look at us doing, gosh, what were we doing, 10 or 12 hours live? And I think in London, 6 to 8 hours live every day. They look at that and they go, what? Oh God, that's just extraordinary. They used to do a packaged highlights that lasted an hour and a half, and it would go out 2 weeks later. For the whole of the America, and you think how many gold medals they're winning at the Paralympics, and how many extraordinary stories, and Tatiana McFadden, various, they've got really high profile, brilliant athletes, and they just weren't showing them. And some of it's to do with they give a lot of coverage to the Special Olympics, and that is connected with the Kennedys, and there's a sort of political side to that. But the Special Olympics is different, and it's not as long or as detailed a competition as the Paralympics, and obviously conditions of entry are very different. And I just think they kind of go, oh, that's the same. It's not. And also, just because you think you've ticked that box doesn't mean you shouldn't cover this. I mean, it's. So I think in that way, we in British broadcasting, whether it's the BBC or Channel 4, I think there's an amazing legacy there of Paralympic coverage that has set a standard that other countries now aspire to.
So this is Claire Balding, you'll know that already. I'm Jonathan Overend alongside Lee McKenzie, and this is episode 2 of series 2 of Sport and the Fields. Paralympic fields running throughout the postponed Tokyo 2020 Games. If you missed the first series, by the way, which ran throughout what would have been the Olympics, you can download it now. I'm interested to hear from Claire her thoughts on Tokyo 2021, as it now will be. We've just got to hope it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is obviously dependent on hopefully a vaccination or indeed control of the spread of the virus, because an awful lot of people with disability have had to, it depends obviously on the condition, but some have had to shield pretty stringently. I was doing an event recently that Sophia Warner, who herself was a para-athlete, she set up a thing called the Superhero Series, and it's a mass participation event, a triathlon normally held at Dorney Lake. And this year, because nearly all of the families who take part couldn't leave home, it became the at-home superhero series. And it was really moving, actually, and very powerful, because quite a lot of kids who competed in it had never been to Dorney Lake anyway, couldn't, because of the severity of their condition, actually couldn't leave home for that long on a normal year. So they were taking part for the first time and setting themselves challenges that they never thought they would achieve, and then exceeding them. And it's those kind of things that I just think have, you know, the resonance of the Paralympic movement is really, really strong. I would suspect, for lots of reasons, that Tokyo has a stronger chance of hosting a successful Paralympics than almost any other nation, partly because they are very, very organised and highly hygienic, but also technologically very advanced. So I suspect that even if Tokyo decided to limit ticket sales to only Japanese nationals or people who are already in Japan, and I've not heard that put forward yet, but I think that might, that could make a lot of sense, because that stops travelling fans who would be much harder to test than travelling athletes. So even if they did that, I think they'll sell out every venue. They are already obviously fully prepped and will only refine things between now and next year. So I'm very hopeful that it could be a really exciting, well, obviously really exciting games, because the sport will make it exciting. But I think they've got a very, very strong chance of hosting a hugely successful Paralympic Games.
And, yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on with that. And, you know, I go to Japan a couple of times every year and have done for about the last 12 years to cover Formula One. And last year I was there for Rugby World Cup. The enthusiasm that they have as a sporting nation is incredible. And I remember back in Rio, I'm not sure if you remember this, Claire, that we had, every time you looked around, there was always a sort of a party from another broadcaster to see how Channel 4 did things, because, you know, Channel 4 were doing things in a very impressive way. And I remember the Japanese contingent coming round and looking round our offices, and they couldn't believe it, because also one thing it's worth mentioning is that Channel 4 have a lot of disability producers, you know, runners in wheelchairs, as it were. Everyone is there. It doesn't matter if they're athletes or if they're on the production team. And they couldn't believe it. And they were so heartened to see it. And they were meant to be in for about 15 minutes to walk around the office. They were there for about an hour and a half. They were just so engaged with what Channel 4 was doing. It with, you know, they were speaking to everybody. They are determined to put on a games for all. And I think that if the enthusiasm and just the engagement that we saw during the Rugby World Cup, and that I get to see in motorsport and things, where they actually all, you know, turn up in almost in fancy dress, dressed as their favourite drivers, dressed as their favourite rugby players and athletes, then that will just be a wonderful thing and a really empowering thing for the Paralympics.
Yeah, and as we've seen in nations like China, I mean, China, as soon as Beijing got the Olympics and Paralympics, they suddenly started to develop a much more powerful Paralympic team. And having not been a major presence through the 80s and 90s, so suddenly in the 2000s, we're like, oh, hello, we've got a lot of Chinese athletes here. When we went to Beijing for those Paralympic Games, in the early stages, the crowds were not great. And then they made an effort to go out into the country and basically bus in thousands of people who had never seen anybody with a prosthetic limb or in a wheelchair being allowed to be being celebrated. You know, there was slightly, and I think this had happened in Greece as well, there are in some countries, there is a tendency to lock people away and you therefore just don't see disability. That's what the Paralympic Games does to the nation that hosts it, but also to all the nations obviously competing and watching. And that's why I think in many ways it has a stronger message, because I think it has a broader resonance, as I keep saying, but it does for me than the Olympics. I mean, it's I think it's you know one of the most important things I've ever been involved in, and It is about performance, and it's about improving performance. Of course it is. And in this country, that means investment in facilities, and it means development of technology as well. But it's also about changing lifestyles for a massive amount of people who may never be athletes, but who can actually see the difference in their day-to-day life and in the place that they work and in the home that they live in.
This progress in terms of sort of perception and attitude, Claire, you know, towards the Paralympics, is it reflected in society as a whole, do you think? How far as a country have we still got to go in terms of our attitudes towards disabled people?
Well, I think it's interesting. If you look at the London Underground and most public transport networks in the UK, we're pretty far advanced. I mean, the Paralympic movement started here. Stoke Mandeville was obviously an absolute epicentre of treatment for injured servicemen, as it was at the time, with spinal cord injuries, and has continued to be. So Dr. Ludwig Guttmann was the guy who then thought, let's have the wheelchair games, and that then became the Paralympic movement. So I think we've always had an attitude that is very, you know, as it should be, broad-minded and understands that quite often it's the practicalities. It's not what we worry, and Lee will join me in this, we worry about language. We worry about, are we saying the right things? Are we, you know, and one does, certainly things in terms of broadcast, I think, have developed and helped people have more honest conversations. But actually it's the practical elements that will be a barrier. So if I remember being in Athens with Tanya Gray Thompson, and in Athens obviously it's an ancient city, and the curbs are so big there is no way you could get a wheelchair you know, up onto that curb. And she said, you know, I don't care what language anybody uses, but would you give me a ramp? And as we know, the ramp at Sports Personality of the Year, or lack of it, became a major factor for Tanny when she finished third in Sports Personality of the Year. And I think those issues are the ones that make everybody wake up, because it's architects designing buildings, it's transport experts designing, you know, the ability to get on and off a tube, for example, in a wheelchair, or if you're visually impaired. Just understanding that general day-to-day life is much, much more difficult if you don't have the benefit of, you know, 20/20 vision and full hearing and being able to walk on two legs. And that is, I think, worth everybody understanding. Because that's the barrier to a lot of people working at high-level jobs. And actually, Liz Johnson, who I know you'll talk to on this podcast, she does really interesting work in going into major companies and saying, are you accessible? Are you truly diverse? Are you actually making the most of the workforce that could be available to you? And highlight very bluntly and very accurately where they're falling short. And it's people, I think people understanding more what they've done to block progress that helps open things up. So it that is where I think Paralympics is part of a much broader thought process.
Just before we wrap up with Claire on episode 2 of series 2 of Sport and the Feels, she reminds me of something.
One thing we didn't touch on overs there, we didn't talk about wheelchair tennis.
It's an omission, so let's put that right, because Claire's a huge fan, as I am, primarily through our work every year at Wimbledon.
Tennis as a global sport is hugely powerful and has a standing, I think, you know, right up there with football and probably motorsport. But wheelchair tennis has been something that I think has really broadened its scope, and we have some very successful, and particularly Gordon Reid and Alfie Hewitt. Yeah. But looking back as well at Peter Norfolk, who was a quad tennis player, carried the flag at the opening ceremony of the London Games. You know, the success of wheelchair tennis in the Paralympics has forced, in a way, the Grand Slams to go, gosh, we must include this. And you know, the US Open doing so, Wimbledon doing so as well, but Wimbledon then moving it onto better courts, show courts for the final.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, that's all, it's all of these messages that are, I think, you know, things happen very quickly once people open their eyes, it can all happen and improve very, very fast.
Yeah, but you want those decisions to be taken, those changes to be made before mistakes happen, don't you? And it's amazing how we still get things so wrong. I mean, look at the US Open this year. It's a really terrible year and an awkward year for sports tournaments. They just wanted to make something happen. But they go about organising their singles draws and they completely ignore the wheelchair players. They kind of assume that the wheelchair players will be all right with that you know, they're kind of in some way second-class citizens. I mean, they've reversed it now, thank goodness. But that's not the way to treat fellow humans, is it?
No, and I think that's where generally I think people, athletes themselves, have been become much stronger at speaking up and saying that is not acceptable. And they're, you know, generally speaking, as a movement, the voices are being heard. I think the structure of various sports is much better now. and more inclusive. But yeah, you know, it's just saying, no, that's not right. And, you know, Lee and I are both involved at Wimbledon at trying to say this court is not big enough for the crowd that want to watch this wheelchair tennis match. It needs to move on to a better court, you know, bigger court. And eventually that happens. But, you know, you have to really push people. You can get exhausted by it, and I understand absolutely why some athletes have just gone, do you know what, I just want to concentrate on my sport. Somebody else needs to do the pushing here because I've got quite a lot to focus on of just getting myself fit and ready.
And I love that confidence of these athletes, and particularly you talk about tennis, Alfie Hewitt, Gordon Reid. You know, these are inspirational young guys that a lot of people are following now. You just have to look at their social media as well. Their numbers are just going up and up. And that is where a lot of people are finding out their news, rightly or wrongly, and are starting to follow these athletes. They want to be able to see them. So it's quite right that, you know, if you're at Wimbledon and you want to watch people that you admire and that you follow, that you should be able to go there. And it should be on a big court. It should be on a show court, for particularly for the final.
Claire, it's been a pleasure again to have you on. Thank you very much indeed. We will leave you to your exciting, hectic lifestyle.
Yes.
Claire, thanks so much. That was really lovely.
Thank you, Claire.
Brilliant. Sorry, I do wang on about the history of the broadcasting of it, but I feel it's really important.
Yeah, it's really important. Hugely important.
So there we go. That's Claire Balding. And Lee, you know her well, and she's a fan of a huge number of sports, as indeed you are. But there's no doubt that in terms of the Paralympic movement, she was the face of 2012, wasn't she? And her work was fundamental to this progress, this change in attitude that we're talking about across this series.
Yeah, absolutely. You always need somebody like Claire who has that passion and enthusiasm and a slight sort of pushiness, as she said. She said she doesn't shy away from these things. She will talk on behalf of other people. And every sport needs somebody like Claire. And actually, a lot of sports are lucky that they have Claire, because, you know, we're talking horse racing, rugby league, tennis, Paralympics as well.
Yeah, the list is endless, isn't it? And I love that image as well of you and Claire, a formidable duo, it has to be said, going into some office somewhere at the All England Club and demanding a better court, a better showcase for the wheelchair tennis players. Absolutely love that. Because, look, I mean, this has come across in the chat. Change can happen, and change doesn't have to take an age. It really doesn't have to go through multiple levels of approval, if you like, if it's common sense, if it's the right thing to do.
Change is quick. I think that's something else that Claire said. We don't have to have a sort of 1, 2, 3, 4 year run-up to make something happen. Change can be as quick as somebody wants it to happen. And I think that's really important for every sport, every broadcaster, every journalist to remember.
Lee, great to have you on, and we'll hear from you again later in the series.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
And we do have a really interesting series on the way for you, a combination of current Paralympic GB athletes, previous medal winners. Tanny Gray-Thompson was on episode 1, so if you missed that, make sure you download that, not to be missed. And also later in the series, you might be aware of this new documentary film that's out now through Netflix called Rising Phoenix, all about the Paralympic Games. Two of the people behind that movie are going to be coming on later in the series. So do subscribe if you haven't already, and we'll be with you next time on Sport in the Fields.
Sport in the Fields is a 94/19 independent production.